the Augsburger Lectureship, which is provided, funded by EMU President Emeritus Dr. Myron S. Augsburger, who is with us this morning, who served as president here from 1965 to 1980, and his wife Esther, who is an artist. This lectureship brings to us annually a noted lecturer to address pertinent topics in the area of Christian evangelism and mission. Our guest speakers this year are Elaine Enns and Chad Myers. They are from California. They have worked in faith-based peace and justice activities for many years. They come to us from the Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries, located in the greater Los Angeles area. Elaine has worked in the field of restorative justice and conflict transformation since 1989 as victim-offender dialogue facilitator, consultant, educator, and trainer. She teaches part-time at the Peace and Justice Academy of Pasadena, California, and is a co-founder of the Word and World School for Faith-Based Activists. Chad is an activist theologian who has worked in social change movements for more than three decades across North America and abroad. He is sought after as a popular educator who animates scripture and issues of discipleship, peace, and justice, and as a lecturer for seminaries, denominational conferences, and activist organizations. Please join me in welcoming them as they speak on the topic Decisionism, Denominationalism, or Discipleship, Call to the Way. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Eastern Mennonite University. Chad and I are grateful to be on campus this week to deliver this year's Augsburger Lectures. Myron describes your institutions as communities of faith in the historic evangelical Anabaptist tradition. Now, this is a tradition that Chad and I share, though we've come to it by very different paths. I grew up in a Mennonite community in Canada, while Chad was a young adult convert to the Christian faith and only very recently became a member of the Mennonite Church. We are keenly aware that it is not easy to stay clear on what it means to embrace Christian faith in this country and in these times. Ours is a culture that is deeply confused about religion, and our churches are often part of the problem. So, in the spirit of the Augsburgers who have contributed so much to the life of this place, we'd like to reflect a little bit this morning on how to make sense of Christian faith. There are two main understandings of faith that predominate in the North American context. One is the tradition of what we might call decisionism. That is, faith at its core is understood to be a decision each individual makes, and in the popular parlance of evangelicalism, to invite Jesus into their heart and be saved. Thus, faith is seen as an existential crisis of salvation. And the main purpose of the church, whether fundamentalist or pietist or charismatic, is to get folk to the altar. Once one is saved, the main work has been done, and the rest, it is believed, will somehow follow. Now, there is power in the notion of an existential crisis, and asking for personal commitment to faith is something that we strongly affirm. But how do we follow Jesus unless we know where he is and where he is going in the real world? And therein lies the problem with much of first world decisionist Christianity. The Jesus they present doesn't actually inhabit our real world. His story seems to be taken place in a fairy tale, and the transaction we are supposed to make with him is strictly in our hearts. It has very little to do with the real terrain of racism or nuclear weapons or poverty. So in this brand of faith, Jesus' historic prophetic witness has been profoundly ignored. Or, as Brian McLaren puts it succinctly, the popular and domesticated Jesus has become little more than a chrome-plated hood ornament on the guzzling Hummer of Western civilization. The other problem, of course, with decisionist faith is that it gets a little imperialistic, offering answers without always understanding the questions. So decisionism often becomes one-dimensional dogmatism. We imagine that most of you here at EMU are too cool for such shenanigans. But let's face it, shrill, militant dogmatism is all around us, and frankly, very little of it is religious. If decisionist personalism is the domain of religious conservatives, the other major tradition of faith, often associated with Christian liberals, is what we might call denominationalism. That is, you may or may not have an authentic personal experience of faith or a deeply held mission, but you are comfortable as a member of a historic tradition. Faith is belonging to a church. Here again, there is much to be said for denominations. We need the continuity of institutions, which at their best bear living traditions, and they often embody real community. At the same time, the danger is that denominationalism rides on the coattails of other people's faith, and this problem is not unknown among Mennonites. And of course, denominationalism at its worst sees churches striving to offer ever compelling venues for religious entertainment. Most of you may have pretty good noses for such theatrics, and maybe you've sworn off church, either because it is just too boring or just too glitzy. But the reality is, too many churches seek success in capitalist terms. Bigger is better. Growth is imperative, and glamour will demand our attention.
Anabaptism and other radical Christian traditions have, at their best, offered a third way to decisionist or denominationalist Christianity, either of which are particularly biblical. And that is the notion of faith as discipleship, as an engaged journey of following Jesus on the way of love, justice, and nonviolence. This tradition, which isn't exclusively Anabaptist, is biblical, and that's worth lingering over for a minute. The earliest story about Christian faith in the New Testament is found in the Gospel of Mark, in which Jesus encounters fishermen at their work and calls them to follow him. Now, this scenario is usually romanticized or trivialized in our churches. Oh, how quaint, fishermen. But the gospel narrative inhabits a very real world of first century Jewish Palestine. That world, Jesus' homeland, was militarily occupied by Roman imperialism, with its ideology of domination, as well as ruled over by a tiny and fabulously wealthy elite ruling class. The poor majority barely eked out a living. And as it happens, the economic structural adjustments that were occurring in the region of Galilee just at the time that Jesus was living, determined that peasant fishermen had been stripped of their native fishing rights so that the bounty of the Sea of Galilee could be taken and shipped for export to the Pax Romana, a scenario not unknown to places like Haiti and Mozambique and Ecuador today. Fishermen in Jesus' time were at the bottom of this new economic hierarchy, the main beneficiaries of whom were Caesar and Herod and tax collectors. It stands to reason, then, that these fishermen would have been particularly responsive to Jesus' message because of the rigid state control of their livelihood and the resulting economic oppression. No wonder, then, that Mark records the response of these marginalized and exploited folk to Jesus' call as immediate. They dropped their nets and followed. Not because it was magic or because he was obviously God, but because he was bringing good news to these poor people. But Jesus' invitation to discipleship required more than just an assent of their hearts. It demanded an uncompromising break with business as usual. And then comes the most famous line in gospel literature beloved to evangelicals, who have traditionally interpreted it to mean that Jesus is calling these men to save souls. And so he is. But we are missing the real point because, like most Christians, we are functionally illiterate in the Hebrew Bible. So hear the echoes of no less than three prophetic oracles that employ exactly the image of fishing for people. The great 8th century prophet Jeremiah envisioned God sending for many fishermen in order to reel in the people of Israel who had been hammered and scattered by empire to the four directions. This was a hopeful ingathering of all those dispersed and dispossessed by the forces of domination. Or take the prophet Amos, who targeted the upper classes of Israel, whom he called, rather impolitely, cows of Bashan, warning that Yahweh would haul all of those who oppress the poor away like sardines to judgment. Or the most clearly anti-imperial oracle in this vein, found in Ezekiel's rant against Egypt's pharaoh, an oracle which denounces the empire's delusion that it owns all of the water resources of the Nile, just like Rome did in the case of the Sea of Galilee in Jesus' time. Yahweh vows to yank the dragon of Egypt right out of that river, hook, line, and sinker, along with all the fish that it claimed exclusive rights to. In other words, Jesus, who not only knew the prophetic literature, but sought to embody it anew in his context, was, in the fishers of men idiom, summoning regular working folk to join him in overturning structures of power and privilege in the world in order to restore God's justice to the poor. Or in modern parlance, he was inviting them to go after the big fish. In the Jesus story, then, discipleship meant following away with very specific social, political, and economic dimensions. It follows that the same ought to be true for us. And the Anabaptist tradition has sought time and again to renew that alternative definition of faith as radical discipleship, a personal and political following of Jesus that prioritizes the poor, seeks justice, and proclaims God's peace. And we think, friends, that is a faith worth keeping.
Jed and I have different stories about how we were called to discipleship. Like I said earlier, I grew up Mennonite in the Canadian prairies, and I really value my early exposure in the church to nonviolence, simple living, and community. I took commitment very seriously, and I waited to be baptized until I was 22 years old, which was really old back then. At that point, I was in my last year of college at Canadian Mennonite Bible College in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I volunteered for the Big Sisters, Little Sisters program. My little sister was also named Elaine, and she was a First Nations Cree. She was 13 years old, she was pregnant, and she was in and out of the juvenile lockup facility. Her three offenses were beating people up, sniffing glue, and stealing clothes. The criminal justice system responded by locking her up in juvenile hall. But there was no help for her to understand how she was hurting herself, how she was hurting others, or any motivation for her to change her behavior. Near the end of the year, a mentor suggested that I go on Mennonite voluntary service to work with the Victim Offender Reconciliation Program to learn about alternatives to the criminal justice system. And being from Saskatchewan, when I learned the program was in California, I immediately signed up. My MVS assignment with VORP was in Fresno. In my first year, I worked with many victim offender facilitations, and one of the most powerful experiences was with Joe Avila. Joe had killed an 18-year-old woman in a drunk driving accident. A few days after the accident, I was invited to go visit with him at Fresno County Jail. That meeting began a relationship with Joe and his family that continues to this day. Joe helped me see the radical power of restorative justice when, in the middle of his trial, against his attorney's strong counsel, he changed his plea to guilty because he saw how the court proceedings were victimizing Amy's family and friends, and he wanted to spare them any further pain. So, of course, changing his plea, Joe was given the maximum sentence of 12 years. After serving his time and having gotten sober, he resumed his life outside, and now he works with Prison Fellowship to continue the work of restorative justice. Others also inspired me in my first years of working in restorative justice, ordinary people who chose radical discipleship under horrific circumstances. For instance, Catholic Marietta Yeager chose to forgive the man who kidnapped and murdered her 7-year-old daughter and has been working on the forefront to abolish the death penalty ever since. Through working with VORP, I found my vocation as a disciple, and I continue to be challenged and inspired by the restorative justice work I am involved in. In our recent book, we profiled several other extraordinary disciples working the frontiers of restorative justice who have become our mentors and friends. These brothers and sisters have encouraged me to go deeper in my faith as a Mennonite. Presbyterian Murphy Davis with the Open Door Community in Atlanta, who works with Georgia's death row. Liz McAllister from Jonah House in Baltimore, who has been at the forefront of nuclear disarmament. Mennonite pastor and Cheyenne Peace Chief Lawrence Hart. And Baptist preacher Nelson Johnson of the Greensboro Truth and Community Reconciliation Project.
On the other hand, I wasn't raised in any church and came to the faith through an evangelical outreach as a young adult. So here it is, 1976, the bicentennial of the country, and I'm 21 years old in my third year of college, and I'm a pretty disillusioned young American, having grown up during the Vietnam War era. I'm also an increasingly disillusioned new Christian. I didn't get all the cross and flag stuff that was going on during the bicentennial. It just seemed somehow idolatrous to me. But all the Christians assured me that it wasn't. So I was looking for a way to follow the Jesus I was reading about in the Gospels, and I wasn't seeing a lot of that in the churches. I was looking, in other words, for radical discipleship. So I did what one does in that circumstance. I took a semester off college and hitchhiked across the country to inner city Baltimore, to a place called Jonah House that Elaine just mentioned, a Christian peace community, which prays and protests and gets arrested for preaching the gospel of peace at places like the Pentagon and the White House. So I'm there, and the patriarch of the community, a longtime radical priest named Philip Berrigan, took me under his wing, and he taught me the most important catechism of my life. One early morning, the two of us were dumpster diving for food. And Phil, he's this grizzled old veteran of the civil rights and anti-war movements of the 1960s. At one time, he was the most famous religious activist in America as the first Catholic priest to commit civil disobedience protesting the Vietnam War. Dude had done years in jail, and he was as tough as nails. At the same time, very grandfatherly, very warm, most of the time, except when he was speaking truth to power or to a young, eager, but clueless Californian. So he's standing there, knee-deep in old tomatoes and rotting zucchini, and it's before sunrise, and it's cold. And he asked me, "So what do you think? Where is Christian hope?" And I'm wishing I was back in college, because at least you could figure out the answer to those pop quizzes. Where is Christian hope? I'm wondering, I don't even know what Christian hope is. So I hem and I haw, and I pretend to search for a prize squash. And Phil starts in. "A lot of Christians," he says, leaning back on the dumpster, "think that hope is in church or in a ritual or pious behavior." He pauses. I shiver, nodding dumbly. "Do you know why we live among the poor and get arrested and go to jail for peace?" he presses, leaning forward. I glance nervously at my watch, thinking, great, I'm stuck in a dumpster with Amos the prophet. It's because we like to hang out with Jesus, and that's where Jesus is. Oh, there's a lot of high-sounding rhetoric about hope from the pulpits, he continued. A lot of nice talk by Christians, who then go and do as they please. And they ignore all the violence and poverty and injustice because they don't see it because they're living in the burbs and driving a nice car. Hope doesn't hide out from the contradictions in yourself or in society. Doesn't insulate itself from the desperate situations of the poor or stand mute before the prospect of nuclear war. I'll tell you where hope is, he says, his voice rising. It's not in your pocketbook or your ideals or your job aspirations or your rhetoric about Jesus. Hope, he says, is where you put your ass. Now, Phil was an old Irish Catholic, and he could say that, and I'm not supposed to say that in chapel, even though it's probably the only thing you'll remember about this sermon. But don't miss the point. Hope is where we place our bodies. That's what counts. What part of town we live in, who we hang out with, who we work alongside, how many social boundaries we dare cross in order to be with Jesus. And there I am in that dumpster, and I'm 21, and I'm young, and I'm impressionable enough to take this stuff seriously, just like we hope you will be. So we began a small intentional community in a poor neighborhood in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we worked at blue-collar jobs and protested and read the Bible and held circle worship in our basement. And that became a way of life because the work was so compelling and the kinds of Christians we worked with across the ecumenical spectrum so amazing. We organized. We helped start the sanctuary movement for Central American refugees fleeing a war that our country was fighting in theirs. We hung out with the neighborhood kids. We grew our own food. We talked to churches about discipleship, just like the new monastic movement today. It changed my life permanently. And I've been in this thing now for over 35 years, and it's the best party in town. But there's still lots to do. Turns out this tradition of faith as discipleship stretches from the New Testament to the 16th century. Menno understood that to be truly evangelical is to care about the marginalized. And in the 17th century, Baptist Roger Williams advocated for the end of slavery on this continent, as did the Quaker John Woolman in the 18th century. He also refused, by the way, to wear clothes made by slaves, becoming the first anti-sweatshop activist in history. And of course, the great Sojourner Truth in the 19th century, who was a conductor on the Underground Railroad and an early feminist to boot. And in the last half century, all kinds of Christians have put their asses on the line, such as Clarence Jordan, a Southern Baptist, integrationist, and founder of Koinonia Farm in Georgia, or Dorothy Day, co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, or Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers, and of course, Ella Baker and Martin Luther King of the Civil Rights Movement, whose asses often landed in jail in their struggle against American apartheid. So the movement of faith as discipleship goes on and on and on like a great river. But you know, some of us are getting a little tired, a little long in the tooth, and we're looking for a new generation to get involved. That would be you all. We need some help up in here. It's your world. And quite frankly, the 21st century, only 10 years old, is a righteous mess. So who's going to speak gospel truth to profoundly consequential issues like genetic engineering or torture or the AIDS pandemic or student indebtedness? That got your attention. Or human trafficking or terrorism or the war on terrorism or peak oil or global warming. The good news is that God is raising up new voices from your generation. And for that, we are deeply grateful.
What we want to give you is a couple examples of ways that you can plug in to this radical discipleship movement. So there are training schools for this sort of discipleship, such as the New Monastic Movement's Schools of Conversion. Word and World is a school and a pedagogic network for faith-based activists that is trying to bridge the gulf between the seminary, the sanctuary, and the streets. And this April, we're launching, which is great news, a non-site-specific mentoring program. So from wherever you are in the country, you can join us, and we're working to equip young adults like you for the ongoing work of radical discipleship. Our cooperative hosts a Bartimaeus Institute in our hometown of Oakview, California. About 25 people come together for a long weekend or a five-day course to explore scripture and social justice. This year, we're going to look at Anabaptist, anti-racist, and anarchist approaches to the Sermon on the Mount. That's on the weekend, and the week-long institute is going to be on bioregionalism and watershed discipleship. I want to remind you again about Mennonite Voluntary Service, which provides a way for college grads to live out their faith through service and community, and it's throughout the U.S. and Canada. So there are ample opportunities for you all to become the next generation of radical discipleship. Radical disciples. There's farming workshops, there's internships at magazines, there's all sorts of opportunities. The way is there, but you must provide the will. Chet and I have been at it since we were your age, and we wouldn't change a thing. Faith-based activism is really the best party in town, and you are invited, because hope is where you put your ass.
Thank you.